Is there anybody on the... this is Tina Dam from ICANN staff. We're just about to start the IDNA protocol transition and experiences session. Just want to check and see if there is anybody on the phone. Okay, there is a caller on the line. which may be us. Sometimes that means that it's us. So, we may not have anybody on the phone line, but at least it is an option. I know that there is potentially people who are finishing the JIG meeting, which is like next door, and they're talking about variants. They're just finishing up, so we may get some more people. There is people there that are remote participants. They may jump over here. So, I think we should just go ahead and get started. Do we have the slides up? All right, great. So I think we're ready to start. So for those of you who just joined, my name is Tina Dam. We're going to try to have a little bit of a different type of session that we normally do at the ICANN meetings. So this one is for... you know, much more practical IDN experience for registries and registrars. There's questions to you guys who are participating to see if it's something you would like to see continuing as practical experience and not so much technical as it is more like operational. So for Katahina, we put the topic of the IDNA protocol transition and experiences of that in because the IDNA protocol was just finished. And I already got some suggestions for... I should make this bigger. Sorry. I already got some suggestions for San Francisco, which is the next ICANN meeting, and that is people have suggested to me that we should have something about the IDN guidelines revision, that we should have reports from the IDN CCTLDs on how they're doing with their launch and so forth, and we have a little bit of that here today as well. And then to see if we can set up something with IDN best practices for registries and registrars. So to preset the session, we're really looking at whether this is something that people want and for input from the registries and registrars for what kind of practical experience it is that they're looking for. Now, I'm just going to talk a little bit about the protocol revision very briefly and the IDN guidelines, and then we're going to go to the speakers. And I hope that you're going to like what they prepared for you. So the protocol revision, first of all, the protocol is this technical standard that basically provide a complete basis for IDNs and how they work in the DNS. That protocol was revised recently. It was approved by the IESG and the IETF in August 2010. The five documents that are listed on this slide are the five documents that the protocol revision contain. And it's something that's been ongoing for a really, really long time and basically has been looking at experiences that have been gained since the IDNA protocol was introduced in 2003. But it is finally complete, and I will say it has a lot of positive effects that needs to be implemented by the registries and that registrars can take advantage of. So these are the three key revision areas, and then the great panel here is going to, you know, talk about that a little bit in different ways. But one is there's a one-to-one relationship between what's the U label and the A label. And the U label, of course, is the local characters, and the A label is the X and dash dash version. Second one is the new protocol is not Unicode version dependent. And that, of course, is extremely beneficial for any new languages or scripts that are, or characters all in all, that are added to Unicode that people want to use in domain names. It does not make a big difference for some of the languages and scripts where IDNs were already available, but it does for some of them. And the third one is reducing problems with scripts that are written from right to left. And that was actually something that we fell over by coincidence. We did not know that that problem existed, but it did, and it is fixed in this new protocol. So so that is great. One subject I wanted to mention that is a big difference between the two versions of the protocol is that the early version, the 2003 version of the IDNA protocol, it produced mappings. It basically meant that if you asked for a registration of where a certain character was contained, the protocol was would map it to something else. And we have some examples being described on that. The new protocol does not do that mapping. So that means that something else needs to be taken care of by the registries or by application developers. So that is something that's still being discussed. And of course, that creates some transition work, which is why it's important that we get this transition done in the right way. Now, the IDN guidelines are, you know, they are a set of guidelines, but they're also requirements. And those guidelines are intended to provide advice and help for that transition. So if you're a registrar or registrar and don't know how to take care of this transition, then the IDN guidelines are supposed to help you with that. Now, the IDN guidelines are under revision to facilitate that support. There are some references on this slide with the latest version, that's 2.2, and that's the one that's under revision. Now, we don't have a revised version out for public comments yet, but we did post a discussion, a draft discussion version, to sort of like facilitate the discussions here. And so in the session today, I have like a couple of outcomes that I would like to see. One is to get input into the working group that's taking care of the guidelines revision, so we can get a new version out for public comments that helps with the transition and provides the information that is necessary. To get that posted for public comments and eventually go into board consideration. So other than just trying to have a practical session and see if it's something that's useful for people, we also have this outcome with the IDN guidelines. So that's where we're at. And I should mention that you know, we're a small group, and I would really encourage like you guys to ask questions and try to create a dialogue as much as you are interested in, or if you have any questions. So with that, I am going to change the order around of the speakers a little bit and ask Marina to speak first since she has a flight dependency. So, Marina, I'm going to put your slides up, and can I ask you to introduce yourself?
Okay. Thank you, Tina. Good morning, dear colleagues. My name is Marina Nikirova. I'm Deputy Director of Technical Center of cctld.ru and .rf. And I'm glad to see you survived after yesterday's party. Thank you for presence. And my presentation is about .ref IDN experience, IDNA experience. Okay. I'm going to highlight on certain critical challenges we faced with regard to our IDN.ref. These are domain registration using IDNA. browsers' behavior, search engines' behavior, and the mail issues. In fact, I should say that unlike some of our IDN friends, we had no trouble and had no problems with technical aspects, and so we can't add anything to proposed IDNA guidelines. The reason is that Cyrillic uses only one script instead of multiple scripts like, as example, in Arabian countries or Japanese or maybe some East countries. So we have not troubles with multiple language, multiple script. The second reason is that we already had IDNA implementation experience in .su. A few years ago, we launched IDN domains in .su. Due to minor promotion campaign, .su did not get much growth of registration, but nevertheless, about 12,000 domains already exist in .su. And the third reason is that we did not do mapping .ru.ref for existing domains, so it's absolutely parallel lines. Much more interesting to tell something about browsers' behavior and search engines' behavior, because it's usage of domains. And we started sunrise period for .ref in May. So in June, we decided to check how browsers work with it. And what we saw? There were certain controversies in the way of main browsers' behavior, as you can see on the slide. And for instance, if you type the Russian Cyrillic domain name, it converts into some confusing combination of Latin letters and symbols, such as XN, minus, minus, PN, and so on. It was not very convenient for users. So also you could be redirected to search results or even to .com page. And it was a problem we aired on the IDN SDC group in June. I want to send many thanks to IDN SDC group. It's very useful and help us solve the problem. Thank you for organizer. And time passed. And the situation has changed dramatically since then. And now we have only minor problems with our browser's behavior. So I can say that these problems is solved. About search engines. Situation is very interesting for us because of the quality of processing Cyrillic search request leaves us to desire more because of if you type in a search string some Cyrillic request, for instance, here is an example. Search request Izvestia. Izvestia is a famous Russian newspaper, Vorotmin News. And if you type Izvestia, you got Yandex. Yandex is the most popular Russian search engine, and it gives us Izvestia.ru only in ASCII mode. Google, only in ASCII mode. And only Enigma, the young and aggressive Russian search engine, gives us result in Cyrillic, Izvestia.rf. I'm not sure you can see on the screen, but if you try, maybe you'll see the search engine's behavior in the screen. Yandex, Izvestia.ru, Google, Izvestia.ru, and only Enigma, Izvestia.ref in Russian. It's a question, why if I type my request in Russian, I should get answer only in ASCII mode? I'm not sure it's convenient for our customers. And the most important question for nowadays is, of course, email. Email, I can say we are receiving a huge amount of questions from our customers about email. When serialized email system will be available, how to work with email in Cyrillic domains, and so on. And fundamentally, in fact, this problem is almost solved now. So you can say, you can send email to the Cyrillic domain, but you cannot type the address in Russian. So I can say that when the email system will work in full power in Cyrillic, we will get the next wave of registration. No, that's almost all. In the end of my short presentation, I can give some piece of advice to future IDN applicants. The most important task, for my opinion, is to raise awareness and educate a national user community about what is IDN, how to work with it, what to do with it, and so on, because it's very important. If we not for all such efforts, I think we could not even boast now such impressive results in .ref as we can do. Thank you. Спасибо за внимание. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Marina. Now, is there any questions for that .ref experiences or comments? There's some over here. And Harold, before you start, while you ask your questions or your comment, I'm just going to apologize for a little bit of uncoordination this morning because, especially for those who are remotely participating, you did not see the slides. I'm going to ask the next presenter to, if I can hand this to the next presenter, and then I'm going to get everything organized for remote participants on my laptop. The reason, if you're a remote participant and you didn't see it, we're presenting from my laptop and I couldn't post the slides at the same time, so I really apologize for this sort of technical glitch that took place. So, Harold, while you ask your question, I'm going to hand the key to the next presenter and see what I can do. I think Chris is the next one up, and then hopefully we'll get that dealt with. So, Harold, go ahead.
For your initial presentation, I was actually able to find it on the website, which might be a good thing. One comment to the point about email. Of course, this is entirely outside of ICANN's remit, but there is a standardization effort in the IETF going on for putting non-ASCII on the left-hand side of the email address. It's called EAI and has been going on for a few years. I was former chair of the working group, and it's now trying to deliver its second version of the protocol specifications for achieving that. So there is hope.
Okay, if there is no other questions, Chris?
Okay, guys, so I'm here today to give you an overview of the experiences that we went through in building an IDN domain name registry system. A little brief background on who Oz Registry is. We can probably skip over this. We're a domain name registry services company, and our domain name registry software is actually used by a fair few of the IDN CCTLDs that apply under the Fast Track program. So why are we talking about this today? Well, you're either probably considering applying for an IDN GTLD or an IDN under the CCTLD Fast Track program. Or alternatively, you may be considering allowing IDNs under your ASCII TLD. At some point in time in the future, it is likely, though, that you will need to support IDNs in your registry solution. So this is a few notes about our experiences. We're going to share what we've learnt and a bit of a high-level overview about our solution and some interesting points for you to consider going further. So why did we implement IDNs? As I said before, we supply registry software to other TLDs. .au obviously doesn't use IDNs. We wanted to remain innovative and up-to-date. We needed to give our customers what they wanted, and we believe IDNs are integral to furthering the reach of the internet. So it was the next logical step for us in our domain name registry software. So what are our goals in implementing IDNs? Our goals were to implement it, obviously, in an RFC-compliant way, of course, but to do so generically and flexibly so that our solution can fit all of our clients and their different policy requirements. Ensure the implementation was easily maintainable, ensure that it could be customized further if that was required, and make sure it was configurable to suit all the various local policies without sacrificing performance, security, or stability. So as responsible TLD managers, we've got to make sure that we minimize confusion for the public, for registrants and registrars, protect people against phishing and other misdirection style of attacks, maintain high security performance standards, protect the reputations of our namespaces, and manage our TLD in the way that an important asset of that nature should be managed. So with that in mind, some of the more important aspects that you should consider when implementing IDNs includes things such as developing your IDN-specific policy, fully internationalizing your registry platform, blocking similar registrations, dealing with bundles and variants, the effects on DNS, any security considerations, performance impacts, effects on registrars, registrants, and implications for the other interfaces into the registry. So there are a lot of different things we could talk about throughout this presentation or throughout this topic, but I'll focus on a couple of key points as part of our implementation. So the first thing to understand is that whilst IDNA is a protocol in the dictionary definition of the term protocol, it's not a protocol in the sense that things like DNS or HTTP or even EPP is a protocol. It's really three main things. It's a way of converting a Unicode string into an ASCII string so that we can put it in the DNS. It's a sequence of steps that a registry has to follow before they accept a name for registration. And it's a different sequence of steps that an application must follow when they go to look up one of these things in the DNS. And that's really what IDNA is all about. And even though we are just registries, we do need to have a full understanding of what happens when IDNs are looked up. So we have to be clear and understand all three of those requirements. So IDNA assumes that any required pre-processing has already been performed by essentially the registrar before the name is sent to the registry for registration. So that means things like ensuring the name is in Unicode NFC form and any other local processing such as the character substitutions or the mappings that we thought about before. Those things are now outside the scope of IDNA and they need to be taken care of before we enter into the IDNA protocol. But to maintain the integrity of the registry, it's important to check that all the rules have been followed. Even though we're going to assume that the registrar did all these things, we need to check and make sure that they have been done. So the steps that a registry must follow when receiving a candidate IDN name for registration, verify that the name is in NFC form and reject it if it isn't. If it was provided as an A label, generate the U label. Or if it was provided as a U label, you're strongly advised actually not to accept it to avoid ambiguities. Validate both the A label form and the U label form and make sure that they're related and reject it if they're not. Reject any names with leading combining marks and reject any names that contain consecutive hyphens in the third and fourth position. That's in the U label, not in the A label, obviously. Following that, verify the domain contains only valid code points as defined in the IDNA standards and reject it if it doesn't. Apply the joiner rules, the context J rules, reject if any of those rules fail. Verify that for each context O code point in the name, there's some sort of rule around that code point, and that once you apply that rule to the domain name, the domain's still valid, otherwise reject it. And if the domain contains any right to left characters, then you have to apply all the BIDI rules as well. So as you can tell, there's a fair amount of things that you need to do to an IDN domain name before you're able to allow it to be registered in your registry system. it's very different to what we do today with just ASCII domain names. So implementing these steps is actually relatively simple. It's a well-defined protocol, and reading the RFCs is pretty easy to understand what you need to do. And a simple implementation of these can be achieved relatively quickly. But there are a lot of methods and a bit more complex ways that you can do things to implement these things efficiently or elegantly. And that can become important when it's particularly around the performance aspect when we're doing this level of checking of a domain name before it's registered. So according to the protocol, now we have a valid IDN domain name. But there's actually not enough just in that. We still need to do some more to make sure that we're protecting users from phishing and other problems that can arise with IDNs. So zone-specific processing, that's the first thing. So apply our local policy. That includes things like checking for duplicate names, applying any local policies in terms of language rules and what characters are able to be used and what are not able to use, checking against reserve lists and so forth. So checking for duplicate names. It's an empty slide. No, it's not. So what are duplicate domains? Duplicate domains are domains that are considered the same as one another. For ASCII domain names, it's relatively simple and it all makes sense to us. It's just case insensitive compare. So all of those examples of example.com domain names there, they're all considered equivalent in the DNS protocol. That makes sense to all of us. Nobody would question that. And in the particular case of ASCII, this equivalency is enforced by the protocol. So it's built into DNS, the fact that these four different representations of that domain name there are the same. But with IDNs, that gets all complicated. So there are many more cases where duplicate registrations may exist. And that can be for a number of reasons. Convention, visually confusing or historic. So the example up there is cafe, the E with the apostrophe above it and the E without. So before IDNs were available, somebody perhaps wanting to register the name cafe sacrificed the E with the apostrophe above it, just used a normal E because that was good enough for them and that was all that was available at that time. But now that we can have IDNs, that's not necessarily the case. There can be non-visual reasons. So the example up there is the Arabic one and the English ones. The problem with this, this is a non-visual reason, and this is actually something to do with the way that Windows is implemented in where Arabic numerals, when they're entered into a Windows interface inside the computer, are actually stored as the ASCII numerals to allow all the standard mathematical functions and so forth to work. So that can get through to applications and cause issues with domain names. And then there's technical reasons. So if you can see up there, it might be a bit difficult to see actually, but the first domain name is... and the other one's turned around the other way, which is interesting, is Alef with Hai Hamza, the Arabic characters, made up of two code points, the Alef followed by the Hai Hamza. The second domain name is Alef with Hai Hamza, but it's a single code point. So Unicode has a lot of these different things. Yeah, it's hard to see. It's turned around the other way. It's a little bit difficult. I did the slides on a Windows computer, and I stuck them on a Mac, and now it's all gone to... essentially, Unicode has all throughout it various ways that you can create different representations of the same characters. You can construct the characters by stringing together a sequence of code points that then make that visually that one glyph or that one character on the screen. And then over time, as revisions of the standard take place, for whatever reason, Unicode decides to put in a single code point that represents all of those glyphs already mixed together. And then now we have to deal with the mess. So there's no single simple rule that we can apply. So no longer just lowercasing is enough, as with ASCII. We just lowercase, there's our unique string, and we're done. But because of all these various reasons, there's not really a simple rule that we can apply. So going back to cafe, because it's easier to understand. So because of convention, somebody registered John's Cafe without the apostrophe above the E. Somebody else comes along and tries to register John's Cafe with the apostrophe above the E. We probably would want to make sure that those two domains are actually considered duplicates and not allow the second registration to go through, because they're so visually similar to one another. that in order to protect the end users from phishing and so forth, it would be a wise thing to do. So implementing duplicates, there's a couple of different ways you could do it. This is the variant generation method. So the idea here is that one character is a variant of another character. So in our example before, the E and the E with the apostrophe are considered variants of each other. So when a domain is created using one representation, the other representation is also considered registered or blocked. So if someone registered cafe.com, we would have those two variants generated and blocked. And that's done by calculating all the variants. But clearly, this can happen at the time of registration, in which case you generate all the variants and store them later. Or you could do it on the input to every command. Every time you get a domain name into your registry system, whether it's an update, a renew, or a create, generate all the variants and check if they already exist. However, calculating and storing these duplicates introduces an overhead. So consider a name, and this is obviously for example purposes only, but consider a name where there's only one variation of several characters in the name. So we have E and our E with apostrophe, and someone registers the fictitious name cafe with a whole lot of E's on the end. You can see all the different possible combinations that can exist between the number of E's or E's with apostrophe in the name. And in that fictitious case that's up there in front of you, there's actually 65,000 different variants of that combination. So you'd have to create all of those and store them in your registry system, and that's just not efficient and not ideal. So, and if we have a domain name with just 32 characters in it, with one variant of each character, that's over 4 billion variants that you would have to generate and store in your registry just from one variation of each character. And if those characters then have multiple variants, which especially in Arabic a lot of characters do, it's just not going to work. It's not the way to be done. So there has to be a better way, and there is. So implementing duplicates using the canonical method. Canonical representation of domain names isn't new. ASCII domain names use the concept. It's built into the protocol. The canonical representation of a name is its lowercase form. The overall premise here is, when we apply this to IDNs, is that we assign each character a canonical form. So in ASCII, the canonical form of a character is essentially the lowercase version of the character. It's just straightforward. So what do we mean by characters? So for the sake of this discussion, a character is a sequence of one or more Unicode code points that represents a component of a word. So A is a character, Aleph with high Hamza as a single code point is a character, or Aleph with high Hamza as multiple code points is a character. So we go through and we assign a canonical form for each of those. Think of it like the base form of the character. In most cases, it'll just be the character itself. So if there's no variant for that, the canonical form is just itself. But sometimes it'll be another code point entirely. Sometimes you canonically map things to nothing at all. And the thing to understand is it actually doesn't matter what character you choose, and you could map them to numbers if you want to. It's just a concept. It's just a way to go about generating a unique key that identifies the domain. So using the canonical form, you would define all the canonical mappings for your zone and then iterate through the string and substitute each of the characters for its canonical equivalent. And that will generate the canonical base form of the label that's being registered. Then using this canonical form of the label is the unique key for the registration, and it represents all forms of the domain name. So a quick example, back to cafe again. If we have the canonical mappings as listed there, A to A, C to C, E to E, E with an apostrophe to E, and F to F, someone tries to register cafe, E with an apostrophe, we will compute the canonical form as cafe as E without the apostrophe. So the domain cafe. So the domain name is cafe E with the apostrophe, but the unique label is cafe E without the apostrophe. So when someone tries to register cafe.com and we compute the canonical form of that, so we do our character substitution, we get the same base form as above. So we wouldn't allow that registration. Slow down, sorry, okay. Trying to fit in the 20 minutes. So we wouldn't allow it to be registered. So if we go back to that fictitious example that we had before, the name cafe with a whole bunch of E's in it maps to the lowercase version, as does one where we alternate between the two, and as does one with all of them and so forth. Every different combination of that is always going to map back to that same base name, so it's blocked from registration. So by computing and storing just the canonical form, we don't have to store the 65,000 or the 4 billion different combinations of the name. And upon input into every function into the registry, we compute the canonical form and we check it against the list. Mapping names to canonical form is nothing new. As I said before, it's exactly the same as what we do with existing ASCII domain names. We lowercase them. In this case, it's just not a function. It's not lowercase the domains. It's we create a configuration within the system to say this will be the canonical representation of this particular code point or sequence of code points. So just as we can lowercase a domain name going into every registry function like search, check, or matching against reserve list or who is, if we apply the canonical mappings to all the names passed to those functions, everything just works. All of a sudden, IDNs just become easy. So benefits of using canonical, it just works. It's linear time regardless of the size of the domain name and regardless of the variant configuration, whether you've got thousands of variants for each character or individual variants for each character. It's efficient, especially when you compare it to the previous method. It saves space and memory, and it's a simple algorithm that's less error-prone and really easy to optimize. So that takes care of blocking a registration or one registration blocking the registration of similar names, but sometimes that's not enough. Sometimes what we want to do is it makes sense for the registrant to be able to make use of both versions of the name. If we go back to our cafe example, it's probably perfectly reasonable for the registrant to expect to be able to use both versions of that name. So it's really the same as the first version of trying to block bundles, generating the variants. But that means it comes with all the same issues. So it comes with all the issues of potentially you could generate a string which has 4 billion different variants, and then you'd have to generate them all and store them and delegate them. So for example, if we have the Arabic 1 mapping to the ASCII 1, and we register the name, the fictitious name again, a bunch of Arabic 1s, we still end up with all the different combinations of the name that need to be provisioned in the DNS. So in this case, there'd be 256 variants. We'd have to calculate, store, and put them in the zone file. And canonical mappings can't help us with this problem. So character variants for blocking all registrations make all combinations important. But when we consider bundling, what we have to do is we have to look at the reason people desire the variants and why they want them in the DNS. And then that presents us with another option. So continuing with our example, even though there's 256 different variants of that string, the only two that actually make sense to be in the DNS and functioning is the all Arabic one or the all ASCII one. It doesn't really make sense that somebody's going to type half the domain in Arabic and then switch the keyboard back to ASCII mode to type the other half. So given that, the variants like the bottom two there and all the other combinations of those, they don't really need to exist in the registry or at least in the DNS. We don't need to worry about them. So we come up with a concept. We call it mutual exclusion, and it's really exactly what mutual exclusion means. It's not a new concept. We use it everywhere in modern day life. We apply it to generating domain name variants, and we can achieve the behavior that we want. So essentially what we do is we break things up into primary groupings and subgroupings. So in this case, the primary grouping is numerals. Our subgrouping here is we have the English numerals and we have the Arabic numerals. And this leads us to the mutual exclusion rule, which basically says if a domain name contains any characters that are in one subgroup, it's not allowed to contain any characters that are in the other subgroup of the same primary group to be provisioned in the DNS, i.e. the characters in one subgroup are mutually exclusive to the characters in the other subgroup. So hopefully with this example, it'll make a bit more sense. So if we have the primary and subgrouping listed there, primary grouping is numerals, the subgrouping is English and Arabic. If we look at the first label that's trying to be registered, because all of the numerals in that string are Arabic, they all belong to the Arabic subgroup under the numeral primary grouping, that string would be allowed to be provisioned in the DNS. Similar with the ASCII number, it will also be allowed in the DNS. But the strings below, because they're made up of characters both from the Arabic numerals grouping and the English numerals grouping, we would reject those as variants, and we would not allow it to be provisioned in the DNS, and we wouldn't need to store them in the registry system. Other things that you need to consider when you're talking about bundling are allowing registrants to turn parts of a bundle off and on. How are you going to do that? The impacts on your other services, DNSSEC and bundles kind of become a bit of a mess. Charging model, should there be one? And any flow-on effects to your accounting and reporting. is a bundle of three domain names that are provisioned to the DNS one registration or three? It's something that you have to think about and decide which way you're going to deal with it. Validating local language rules. This is really straightforward. In short, they're anything. They're whatever the local policy is going to be set for those IDN names. At a really simple level, it's what code points you're going to allow for registration within your zone. So, for example, if it's an Arabic zone, you're going to say, here's the list of the Arabic code points which I allow, and you're not going to put the Chinese ones in there or so forth. Dealing with edge cases, so potentially mapping the ASCII AE to the Unicode AE single character, or the S-sharp to the S-sharp. Dealing with final form sigma in Greek and so on, there are a lot of edge cases that need to be handled in different languages. So it's important that the business rule engine within your registry system is flexible and cuspable enough to be able to handle all of these requirements. So putting it all together, how do we represent your IDN configuration in a generic way, and a way that reduces the management and configuration overhead, and hopefully is easily understood by non-technical people? And does anyone understand that? Essentially, within our system, we have what we call a language set. So a language set is a set of languages that are designed to work together under a particular zone. Each language set is defined as a set of canonical mappings. Canonical mappings for each language set, or each set of languages in a zone, need to be the same. Otherwise, blocking registrations doesn't work properly. And within the language set, we have our normal languages, which are made up of the allowed code points for that language and the mutual exclusion groups for that language. And this is all just the tip of the iceberg. This was all these 30 slides or whatever they were. There's just one little problem that you have to deal with IDNs. There's a whole bunch more. Performance implications. TLD registries generally have performance and service level targets. Validating all these rules and cross-checking and all these things that need to be performed now because of IDNs, especially on domain availability checks and so forth, has a lot of implications on the performance of your system. A lot of the ASCII tricks that you used to be able to use are now invalidated. So the byte size used to be the string length. That's not the case anymore, so we can't use that optimization. Byte equivalency is not the only case of equality anymore. We have to generate these canonical forms and compare those. Lower casing is not the only pre-processing required anymore. So all of a sudden, registries become more complicated and have to do more things in the 10 milliseconds that they're supposed to turn these commands around in. So it's tricky to implement and get it correct. And multi-zone registries where you have mixed IDN and non-IDN zones, you'll even incur a performance hit on the non-IDN-enabled zones because now that you're IDN-aware, you're going to have to do a certain number of checks to try and figure out whether you are or aren't dealing with an IDN. You have to consider the effects on registrars, registrants, and end users. It's different to ASCII domains, clearly. Registrars have a harder job to do now. They have to interpret what the registrant is trying to register, somehow turn it into something that kind of looks like it's remotely protocol valid. So do they do some mappings? Do they not map? Do they convert it to NFC? Do they make the user type in NFC? If I go to a website on my Macintosh and I type in an Arabic name into a domain name registration box, it doesn't necessarily get typed in there in NFC form. So the domain name that actually is going to end up getting registered is not actually the one that I typed in. So how do we tell users how this all works? You're going to provide tools to registrars to help them out, and we need to ensure a consistent message to registrants and end users. More areas to consider. IDNA, it's internationalized domain names and applications. So whilst we're collecting registration of IDN names, registry systems are applications as well. So that means we have to implement all of the application parts of IDNA as well. How do you change language rules in an already established zone? And this is something that, Pat would have talked about if he was here, but I'm sure somebody else is going to cover. The effects on EPP, so we have all this extra information. How do we deal with variants and so forth? And we have to return all this information to registrars. How do we do that? And there are a lot of security considerations. Puny code overload, people, if they maybe deliberately or even accidentally, could send in a Unicode string that overloads the puny code algorithm and sends your system into mayhem if you don't deal with these things. Puny code reverse engineering, so people that deliberately register invalid IDN names because they want the XN dash dash version because it spells a word or something that's not supposed to be there. And handling of supplementary characters, which is something that's almost impossible in Java at the moment, so you have to be very careful of. So internationalizing your registry is important to consider. There's no point offering IDN registrations if your entire interface is in English. It just doesn't make any sense. Unicode versions understood by the software in use. Consider how that works. I mentioned the Java issue before with supplementary characters. Registrars, registrants, effects on DNS, increases to your own file size. Do I use DNAME or NS records for variants? Increases in complexity. When I look at my zone file now, it has XN dash dash something in it. I don't know what domain name that is. It's a lot more difficult to use these tools, the existing tools that we use anyway, to manage these things. Infrastructure requirements, IDNs, variants, and DNSSEC. That's a mess that someone's going to have to deal with at some point in time. So IDNs are hard to do right. But there are creative, innovative solutions to all the issues that are mentioned. You need to start experimenting and share your knowledge with the things that you come up with. And help is out there if you want it. Our organization is more than happy to assist anyone that's trying to get these IDN things off the ground. That's it, I think. I hope that was worthwhile.
Thanks, Chris. Questions?
Thanks, Chris. That was really helpful. I just have a couple questions that are really sort of from a novice point of view. But with your cafe example, for example, the E is the only character that's not in the standard, ASCII alphabet.
Yep.
So you're mixing standard ASCII with non-standard, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And so that would not be treated by the mutually exclusive.
Yeah, you can apply the mutually exclusive algorithm to ASCII names if you need to.
Okay. And then secondly, and this is just sort of more of a practical thing, perhaps the guy that registered John's Cafe really wants the one with the accent over it.
Yep.
But that's going to be rejected unless he terminates the first registration or something, right?
If it was a transition scenario, for example, where he registered the one without the accent on it to begin with, and then IDNs were then enabled in that registry system, and he tried to register the other one with the accent because now he can, it would be blocked and he wouldn't be able to get that. But I would assume that in that case, the registry would have a functionality for turning on variants of the existing name. So the way we handle that is that in our system, if you want a particular version of a name to be provisioned in the DNS, as long as it's canonically equivalent to a name that you already own, then you can turn that one on. And so the system has a set of rules that automatically generate the variants that the policy body assumes or dictates that you get by default, but it doesn't then restrict you to just those ones. You can then turn on whatever other additional ones as long as they're canonically equivalent.
Thank you.
There's more questions. And can I ask you to pass the... While we're talking to you.
Still with the cafe word, what you just said, does it apply to the SOS system, the registration system, or to the DNS as well?
Yeah, all of this is about the registration system.
So there's come my question. Cafe without the apostrophe and cafe with the apostrophe, they translate to different A labels. One is the IDN, one is the Latin word.
That's correct.
So supposedly there is someone wants to register the cafe with the apostrophe and is able to register because no one registered the John's Cafe, the Latin word. Now, you at the registry, you using the canonical method, what I understand, you map or convert the John's Cafe with the apostrophe to the John's Cafe without the apostrophe. So actually, it translates to an A label, which is a Latin word. Now, he was able to register the domain as a John's Cafe with the apostrophe. He's going to publish to his customer this kind of domain with the U label with the apostrophe. When they go to the DNS, try to put on the URL this name, it's going to be translated differently to another A label. So how do you manage with that?
Yeah. So the canonical form doesn't have anything to do with the DNS. The canonical form is just about trying to generate a unique key to represent the set of domain names. So if the person tried to register John's Cafe E with an accent, the actual thing that would go into the DNS would be the XN dash dash translation of Punycode version of that. The canonical form that is computed, John's Cafe E without the accent, is just used as a unique key in the registry to uniquely identify that particular domain name. It's got nothing to do with the DNS.
So a person typing the U label at the URL will actually get to the John's Cafe, the Latin word.
No. The canonical mapping has nothing to do with the DNS. They're two completely different concepts. So that the canonical mapping is only used in order to generate a unique identifier for the domain name, so that when somebody tries to register a different domain name that canonically maps to the same, it's blocked. That's all.
Yeah, but my point was that no one before has registered John's Cafe, the Latin word. So the John's Cafe with the apostrophe did go through.
Yep.
And so you translate the John's Cafe with the apostrophe as a Latin, actually as a Latin word. And it has nothing to do with the domain name XN dash dash something.
The unique key for that would be, yeah, John's Cafe. But I could canonically map it to 1234 if I wanted to. It doesn't matter. As long as when the input to that canonical function is John's Cafe, it comes out with 1234. And when it's John's Cafe E with the accent, it comes out as 1234. Then that causes those two strings to block each other out.
So yeah, but what I don't understand is, since you just said that the DNS is totally separate, and I understand that, it's totally separate from the SOS. You're doing some method in the SOS system which doesn't apply to the DNS system. So if I'm going, after registering the John's Cafe with the apostrophe at the SOS system, going to the DNS, and it converts to XN dash dash, where at the registry, while registering the domain, it didn't translate into XN because you made that switch.
No. That's not how it works. So the registry would still translate John's Cafe E with an accent into the XN dash dash form and put that into the DNS, right? So the information that goes into DNS is completely independent of the canonical mapping that is created. The canonical mapping is just a representation of the string that goes into the database, into the registry database, so that when you get another registration attempt and you canonically map that, you can check against all the existing canonical representations to see if that domain is already taken.
Okay, got it. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks. Our next speaker on the panel has a question.
I actually wanted to ask Chris a question.
Vladimir, please just state your name.
My name is Vladimir Shadrunov. I'm director of policy for Telnik, the .tel registry. But before I start talking, I just wanted to ask Chris one question. So let's imagine a TLD where you have multiple character tables and you support multiple languages or scripts. These character tables can overlap, for example, like the case with Japanese and Chinese, right? Let's look from the registrar perspective. When you register a domain, you add a language tag in the EPP command, and then which triggers the check process on the registry side, which checks against character tables. What are you doing with the check command? Is there a way to, from the registrar perspective, to verify whether the name is syntactically correct? And how do you deal with it? Do you need to add a language tag into the check command, or you do something else?
No, so the way that we deal with the check command is, so the canonical mappings are not language specific. The canonical mappings are zone specific, because your idea is to keep your zone, regardless of how many different languages you have, your idea is to keep your zone unique, right? So that it doesn't matter if I'm registering in version 1 of Japanese or version 2 of Japanese. If the version 1 registration goes in, and that name is confusingly similar or whatever it is to something in the version 2 of Japanese, that version 1 registration has to block that version 2 registration.
Yeah.
So on the check command, what we do is we don't have a language tag, so we don't know what language they're trying to register in, but it doesn't matter. We just compute the canonical form of the name that's trying to be checked, and we just verify that that canonical label is not already taken.
I'm not talking about whether the name is taken or not taken. What I mean is that whether the name is syntactically correct or not, meaning that all the characters belong to the character table that they have to belong to, such as are all the characters allowed in this register? For example, if we take Chinese language, are all the characters in the U label, do they belong to the allowed set of code points or not?
So if the characters don't have canonical mappings, then they're not allowed in that zone. So the check that it doesn't do, it doesn't check that. So I may be able to try do a domain check with a label that is made up of characters from the two different languages, right? And because there are canonical mappings for there, it'll do the canonical mapping for those, verify that that domain is available, and return available. Now, the EPP specification says that check is just a indication as to whether or not the domain name may be available. It doesn't say that it is. Right, so in order to we sacrifice perfect functionality for performance, right? And so however, that being said, we have an IDN check command that we added to our registry, where if registrars are concerned about having a absolutely 100% guaranteed yes/no answer, they can use the IDN check extension that we built. But if they're just going to use the normal EPP domain check that doesn't allow you to send through a language tag, then that's what we do.
Thank you. Clear.
We have an online participant question.
Okay. Yeah. Go ahead, please.
Thanks. The question is, and I'm not able to read some of the examples because they're in Arabic, but there could be two names now at the second level that end up being canonically already registered that end up being canonically equivalent.
Yep.
What will happen with those?
So far, we've been lucky that every single one of our launches has been fresh, new IDN ccTLD namespaces. So we haven't had any issues to do with that. But realistically, that's a policy decision. There's no technical decision there. That's if your language policy is such that two strings that are currently registered are now considered equivalent, then you have to make a policy decision about what you intend to do with that. You might create an exception and grandfather them, or you might tell someone they lose their name, I don't know. But the policy body will have to decide what to do in that scenario.
And can I add, so when you say the policy body, you of course mean that's a registry policy / business decision.
Yeah.
There is no like general overall policy that DICAN policy bodies are deciding on something like that.
No, I was more referring to CC space where, yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, I think we have about half an hour left, and we have two more presentations. So, Vladimir, can you go ahead and talk about the .tel experiences?
Sure. I'll try to be quick then. Okay. So, .tel, we launched in March. We went into open registrations in March 2009, not so long ago. We started supporting IDN in June 2010, just a few months ago, our IDN support is quite advanced, as I think, specifically relative to the size of the TLD. And there's a reason for that, because .tel is specifically appealing to small and medium businesses, and there may be situations when those type of businesses do not have much international contacts, and for some .tel users, both the holder of the domain name and all the users of their domain name may be non-English speakers. So therefore, we always try to make the entire .tel experience completely available in local language. We support IDNs per ICANN guidelines. That essentially means that we do have language tables. We support the IDN guidelines, basically that is inclusion-based approach. So that means whatever characters belong to the character table, they are allowed. All the others are not allowed, and mixing scripts is not allowed either. We support 16 languages, which are 12 European languages based on Latin script. I won't list them all, but these are most of the existing European languages. We support Russian, which is in Cyrillic script. We support Chinese, Japanese, and Korean, which use a mixture of various scripts. The approach we've taken with regards to IDN policies is, let's say, not to reinvent the wheel. Registries are the most conservative part of the industry, and we would like to make sure that whatever we do has passed through the scrutiny and through the check of the community, and it's free of errors, and it basically represents a consensus of some relevant community. We therefore are taking policies that have already been generally implemented somewhere or have passed through some consensus-based policy development procedure. We take them from local CCTLDs that speak those languages, or from the implementations of other GTLDs, or from RFCs developed by the IETF. So we do have a number of measures in place to mitigate against character similarity. These are supported in three of our 16 languages. Chris already covered what blocking and bundling is, made it quite thoroughly, so I will just list measures we have in place. For Chinese, we support both bundling and blocking. So essentially, you can get up to three domains at one price, at the price of one domain. If you apply for a Chinese language string, you automatically get all simplified and all traditional form. These domains are handled as a bundle. So that means that they are registered at the same date, expire at the same date, and they have the same set of name servers. What I described was bundling, but we also have blocking in Chinese, which acts in a similar way. If you have a string with simplified characters, you are not able to register an equivalent string with traditional characters, and so on. With Japanese, Japanese uses several scripts: hiragana, katakana, and scripts known as CJK, Chinese, Japanese, Korean. There are some instances where characters, for example, in katakana are very similar to those from CJK, and we do block those. With Russian, it's quite an interesting example because we have... we are the first implementation in the world that has a mix of Cyrillic and Latin characters in one zone, and which takes care of character similarity. If you remember what a homographic attack is, that term was first mentioned, I think, many years ago, and the notorious example that was given was PayPal, where one of the A characters was actually Cyrillic. There was an RFC produced by the IETF just 2 or 3 months ago that addressed this issue and gave consensus recommendations of what constitutes a similarity between Cyrillic and Latin characters. So we do support this. So now in .tel, if there is a PayPal in Latin registered, you won't be able to do that notorious example of homographic attack. Dotel is special in many ways, and the way it is special has an impact on our IDN experience, and particularly IDNA transition experience. Dotel is a sponsored TLD. We have a sponsored community. The purpose of the STLD is allow storing and publishing contact information in the DNS. We do it in the form of NAPTA records. NAPTA records were used widely in the system called ENUM for mapping telephone numbers to domain names. So the sponsored community is very clearly defined by usage. So if you one registers a name and publishes a NAPTA record in it, as contact information, that person belongs to the community. If someone intends to use a domain name for a website address, that person does not belong to the community and cannot register a domain name. So we have a technical solution to the eligibility criteria problem. We so-called authority check on the registry side that checks the DNS, and if there is a NAPTA record in the zone, it activates the domain. If there is no NAPTA record in the zone, it does not activate the domain. So we basically have about 99% of the domains actually resolving to the websites. So there are two criteria for our TLD. First, NAPTA records are mandatory, and second, custom A records are not allowed in the TLD. That means that you cannot have a custom website with .tel. All .tel names resolve to a single page, which we call a proxy page, which basically has a back-end engine that gets information from the DNS and renders it in the user-friendly form. On the slide, you can see a screenshot of my own domain, vlad.tel, where you can see my phone numbers and Skype IDs and so on. How do we do that? I mean, this is not really obvious. How do you disallow A records? Normally, with a .com or any other open gTLD, you can register the domain name or delegate it to your own name server and do whatever you want with it. In our case, in .tel, name servers can only run by parties that have a license from Telnik. In order not to scare off registrars, Telnik can do it on registrar's behalf. We have our own quite large-scale system of DNS servers and of the provisioning system which registrars are using. Those who have a license from us must run a provisioning system which consists of a web interface, which you can see on the slide, and where the API is also mandatory. In our case, this is SOAP API. So, talking about the IDNA transition, the SRS part. Now we have the IDNA BIS standard makes no distinction between the registry and the zone administrator. That means that whatever requirements are in the imposed on the registration side, the registry now has to comply with all those. Most of these are taken care of through the concept of character tables. So we have checked, and all the characters that we support belong to the allowed Unicode repertoire. Besides that, there are some new requirements in the IDNA BIS that we need to comply with. First, we need to verify that the U label contains at least one non-ASCII character. This is quite an obvious requirement. The other two are not that obvious. U label should not contain hyphens in third and fourth positions. So this is the requirement that comes from A labels, but it should be consistent through both A and U labels. The third requirement is that ulabel cannot start or end with a hyphen. This is something, some new requirements that we need to implement in the SRS. I didn't mention that the SRS implementation we are using, we take A labels for registrations. So we take A labels, then on the registry side we convert them to U labels and then run through all the necessary checks. One interesting issue from the IDNA BIS is the SZ. There are several examples, I believe. There is a Greek letter with a similar problem, but we do not support Greek as of yet. So we only have the issue with SZ. The German letter, which in the 2003 version of the IDNA was mapped in the name prep stage to a combination of two S letters, ASCII letters. In 2008 version of the IDNA, SZ is a valid label. There is no mapping. So registries that claim to be supporting German language, a good idea for them will be to allow SZ and include it into their character tables. Now we have a problem. What are we going to have with what are we going to do with those people who would have registered their names with SZ if such character was available? So there are a few possible approaches. For example, we can do a sunrise period, some kind of a sunrise period where we will allow preferential rights to. Existing domain holders who have a domain with double S, and we will allow them to have a first take on the new SZ character and register, be the first to register a domain equivalent domain with an SZ. Then we can do similar mechanism of blocking and bundling as we do with Chinese. This all sounds nice, but technically this is really a complex and expensive procedure to implement. Now, this is something .tel specific. We do not provide registrations on the third level, but as all name servers are run by parties licensed by us, we effectively have some form of control over what gets registered on the third and higher levels. Because we produce and we run the software that the provisioning system which actually inserts those labels into the DNS. So in this software, which we call telhosting, we need to, in order to make it IDNA BIS compliant, we need to perform a number of new syntax checks, which are first all the checks that I already mentioned for the SRS side, such as double hyphens and so on. Besides, we need to the telhosting software needs to make sure that all the characters provided in the label are allowed per new IDNA standard. No punctuation characters or anything like that are allowed, hard characters and so on. The other rules, the ULABEL must not begin with a combining character, must not contain characters whose validity is context-dependent, and must meet the bidirectional criteria. Issues. We have them. So, first, IDNA BISIC is quite a new standard. I believe that most of the browsers, even if you take their latest versions, are not yet compliant, in the sense that, for example, they still map the SZ character to double S. If we did allow SZ character at this very moment, those who register these domains will not be able to use them in the web browser or any other applications. So for us, it didn't sound like a good idea to implement that at this moment before the new code points get implemented by the browsers. Second, we We as a registry, as I said, we are quite conservative in our approach to software and policies. And of course, we would like to use the software libraries that have passed through all the beta testing and so on. We use Java in many places, such as telehosting software. And last time I checked, the more or less standard IDN library, java.net.idn, it still was working per old IDNA standard. So I think before we really start transitioning to the new standard, we need to make sure that we have software libraries available. And I think that's it. So if you have any questions, you're welcome.
Thanks, Vladimir. I have a couple of questions, but it's for the whole panel, so I'm going to wait until we have the last presenter done. Is there any questions on the online participation? No. Okay, so that's very nice. So we have good remote participation. So our last... So thanks, Vladimir. Our last speaker jumped in sort of like in the last second, Michael Young Affiliates. So no slides on this one, but some stories I hear.
Thank you. Yes, lots of stories, a little bit of meat to this one. I was asked in at the last minute, so I do apologize about the slides. And yes, I am sort of winging it here on this one, but we've had some really interesting experiences around legacy IDNs that I thought be of interest to this group in particular. So I have Representative Michelle Kuhn over here in the front from PIR, and with PIR support, I'm going to talk a little bit about org and the legacy IDNs, how we handled those there. For some of you who aren't familiar with the history, back in the day, there was a earlier predecessor to Punicode referred to as RACE. And RACE was an attempt to solve the IDNA problem that never saw a full completion, and we shifted to the Punicode efforts. But there was quite a number of registrations done when org was under its previous operator. When org was transitioned over to PIR, 150,000 of these legacy IDNs came along for the ride. And they were in this race encoding. So we had an interesting problem. How would we take these existing registrations and fit them into the 2003 version of the IDNA protocol? How would we deal with the compliance? How would we respect the issues of the registrars and the registrants who had taken a chance on these registrations? So what we did, after much consideration and hand-wringing and thinking this through, is actually convert them back to a Unicode. They were stored in ASCII and RACE. We convert them back to Unicode points. And then from the Unicode point, we went back through name prep and then through Punicode and converted them to Punicode. Now, in some registrations, we got garbage. Others were mixed scripts. Others were pure. There was quite a variety of things that happened. Actually, most of them came through that transition intact. It was surprising. We kept all the registrars, or rather PIR kept the registrars informed of the results of that technical work along the whole way. So we produced specialized reporting for them, showed them what had come up. And at that time, no official IDN support was being launched at org. That was just the first step. And we basically warehoused all those registrations, whether or not they came out as recognizable Punicode or not. They were stored and kept in the registry database. So going forward, as each language has been, the policy has been developed around it, what both Affiliates does with .info and PIR does with .org is typically to launch a new language is entertain a relationship with an appropriate language authority, develop language policies around that language, including including considerations toward variant packages and so forth. And once that's been arrived at and there's support of that language authority, then we create our language tables or mapping tables to support that policy. So in each case where a new language has been launched in .org, the process is pretty interesting. What we do at that point is examine all the registrations, these legacy registrations, which are currently in a non-charging locked state. And if any of them fit into the policy of whichever language is being launched at the time, we apply the new language tag to that particular registration. And at that point, it becomes unlocked and it auto-renews. After all this time, it finally becomes active and starts its lifestyle. Its life cycle. So at that point, the registrar is explicitly notified that this is going on, and they have the opportunity within the auto-renew grace period to say, well, thanks that it's working now and it's resolving and active, but no thanks, I'll delete it. Or if they find value in that legacy registration, they can continue with it, assuming there's still a registrant somewhere there that originally, almost 10 years now back on the original registration or the experiment around the race, IDNN, was an IDNA yet then, but IDN test beds that VeriSign ran back then. So let me talk a little bit about version 1 to version 2 on IDNA, because there's maybe a little bit of learning that that is useful to everybody. We really don't anticipate, and we've done some initial examination, but when we actually upgrade officially from version 1, and ORC upgrades officially from version 1 to version 2, that we will have any legacy issues between version 1 and version 2 because of very careful work with those language authorities in developing the policies. There was a lot of not just thinking about the cultural semantic issues, all those things very important, but also there was a great deal of thought put into, anticipating the future. And at the time, the 2008 version of IDNA was being thought through and some of the issues were on the table and anticipated. So as a result, all the existing registrations in .org and .info, we don't anticipate any problems moving from version 1 to version 2 or any work to be done at all. Now, I say we anticipate because we haven't completed our analysis 100%, but that was the intention. So there's a lot of strength in, and ability in developing your language mapping policies, your language tags, developing some purity in it. Typically, to date, we haven't done much in the way of mixed scripts in language tags, often because there's a lot of controversy with language authorities about that issue. In some cases, it's valid and accepted, but we never, as registry operators, should be making those judgments. We should have an authority that specializes in language helping us with those decisions.
Thanks, Michael. So let's see if there's questions in the room. And Patrick, you have one?
Yeah. Patrick Jones from ICANN staff. Michael, can you talk a little bit about what Afilias is doing with enabling IDN email? In is it a test, or can you talk about that a little bit?
I would love to. As some of you know, there's some related work on that's just about wrapping up in the ITF now. It's related to the IDNA work to deal with. IDNA was really dealing with the right side of the email label, and it's the left side of the email label, and the work is almost completed now. For some time, we've had a lot of support in the ITF. We've offered a lot of support from our engineers on this, and Afilias actually has a fully working and operational IDNN-enabled email platform on these standards. Soup to nuts. It works on mobility platforms. It works with a web-based email client. We've got all the way from IMAP to SMTP. The whole email infrastructure works. So it's we're very proud of that. We think it's a really, really great advance technologically, and it helps really add value, we think, to the advent of IDNs.
Okay, great. So we're still open for questions, and we have a few minutes left, but I have a couple of questions. And by the way, I think this email work is great as well. I think it's going to be very useful, and I think it's going to be interesting to see how the market takes that up. So I have a couple of questions, because this, as I said in the beginning, this really is sort of like a trial session to see if it's necessary and useful and so forth. We got some online compliments that they find that it's interesting. I think it's extremely interesting. The people you see on this panel are experts when it comes to operational implementation of IDNs. Oz Registry, I think you guys were one of the first ones to implement the new protocol, if not the first one. DATEL is very, is special in its own way in the type of registry that it is, so you have some certain other things that are necessary. We have the IDN ccTLD experience. Marina had to leave because she had to catch a flight, but so .RF is one of those, right? And we're obviously going to get more and more experiences from the IDN ccTLDs as they're coming out. And then we have the Afilias PIR, old transition between the testbed and the protocol back early on, and now between the two protocols. And Pat Kane from VeriSign, as you may have seen on the schedule, was supposed to be here and talk a little bit about the .com transition, which is another major transition between two protocols because they have a big volume of IDNs. So I think think from the staff side, we feel like there's a lot of experience and a lot of expertise there. At the same time, what I hear about a lot of complaints from end users, and I heard a little bit about this week as well, is that not all registrars are implementing IDNs or are offering them. I know that some things that it's a little bit difficult and challenging. I will admit that Tim and I haven't really coordinated on this, and I don't have a good overview of how many registrars are supporting and how many are not. I just hear a lot that some are not, and it may just be coincidence. But so my question is really is, would it be good for us to do some registrar coordination? The panel is, experts in their own way. So I would love to hear from the panel members. Do you guys think that would be useful? But so much more, I think it's a question that we should send out to the GTLD registry stakeholder group and to the registrar constituency to see if this is something that's necessary to continue on. But just quick answer from the panel, what do you guys think?
Yeah, we as registries at the moment are not allowed to deal directly with the consumers of our products, and the registrars are our basically retail channel. We therefore, input from registrars, from my point of view, would be very useful for us with regards to what do consumers think about those issues, and how what our retail channel thinks about those issues.
I can't speak for the entire RYSG, but in general, we've all been very supportive of IDNs. And I think any opportunity to raise the issue and talk about it at length with registrars is positive and exciting. And hopefully we'll get more and more registrars excited and involved in supporting IDNs.
Yeah, I would also agree. There are a lot of difficulties or potential difficulties in registering or offering registration of IDNs. So I definitely think it would be worthwhile to be able to step registrars through those processes and those things that they need to consider rather than letting them stumble through it on their own.
Tim, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say that I think registrars find, accessible and meaningful presentations like this, really helpful. Unfortunately, there is a kind of a significant conflict at this time right now for quite a few of them, or else they would be here. But in any case, what I always suggest is that if at all possible, we can do things like this, but also have some takeaways. because you're not always speaking to, you know, the people that come to the ICANN meeting aren't always the same people that are implementing some of these things. So I recommend, you know, that we might also want to think about, you know, the basics, you know, some kind of basics materials that they can take back to people in their organizations as well.
Yes, I think that's a good point. We've talked a little bit internally on staff on creating some more useful material, some that goes directly to end users, some that goes to registrars, some that goes to registries, because it really is different interest groups, and I think they need different material. The other thing I'm going to mention is that Chris was nice enough to demonstrate to us is this problem with IDNs that we're going to continue to live with for a while when you switch between you know, copy-pasting or switching between applications or even operating systems. It really does make a difference. And I think when we talk about registry and registrar coordination of groups of things, I think we want to take that application level into consideration as well. All of those topics are, like, complete practical, operational, you know, not at all policy or technical development specific issues. So, I hear is that it's a positive sense to try to have these types of sessions. So with that, I think we're a little bit over time, and we're going to close the session. So I just want to say thank you to the panel members. I think you guys are doing an amazing job on this type of implementation. So thanks.